I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Agora Podcast Network's The Exchange. I'm your host, Tom Daly. As an avid podcast listener, I'm always looking out for new shows to add to my subscription list. While the majority of what I listen to is history-oriented, I'm always interested in finding quality podcasts that help me broaden my view of the other disciplines that comprise the liberal arts. And literature is one of my big blind spots. This is why, for me, one of the most exciting new podcasts that I came across in 2017 was The Cannonball. The Cannonball is that rare podcast that can both speak intelligibly about a technical subject and do so in a lighthearted and unaffected way. The Cannonball is an exploration of the complex motivations behind the incisive social commentary within and the humor inherent in the great works of the Western canon that, their original meaning being obscured by time, are too often taught as grim, moralizing, two-dimensional tales, if they are discussed at all. Hosts Claude Myron Guzer and Daniel Doughty combine their unique individual perspectives and talents to draw out the rich contextuality of the works that have built the Western literary tradition. So without further delay, dear listeners, I present to you my interview with The Cannonball. Welcome, Claude Myron Guzer, and welcome back to our returning champion, Daniel Doughty. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's glad to have you. I'm really excited to have you guys join me because I'm excited to talk about The Cannonball. Now, I did want to start with the exchange neophyte here, Claude Myron Guzer. Now, do you mind if I call you Goose?
Sure. I'll go by any of that. My day job, right. I'm usually answering to "Hey, asshole." So that's
well, Goose. I'd like to start with you because people are just being introduced to you, really, you know, through these early episodes of The Cannonball, and I wanted to discuss your background a little bit. Now, I have here in my notes that you are an elitist ivory tower intellectual. How is that going?
About as well monetarily as you would think. That's an interesting way to put it. When Daniel and I started this, I sort of pitched it to him as, you know, we're a couple of well-educated autodidacts, and that's honestly how I've sort of felt in academia for a while. There's a lot, and that gets at sort of what The Cannonball is. I've got a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in English, and I can do the academic stuff. And I do it for a living, but there's also this sort of like affective thing that's left out. And Daniel and I figured, hey, this might be a cool way to get at that. So does that sort of help answer your question? It's, on the one hand, a profession, a job that leaves me exhausted, usually by about 6 o'clock in the evening, and yet I persist.
There you go. I am always interested, and you kind of touched upon it a little bit, is what makes somebody take the leap from being interested in an area into actually podcasting about it. So what caused that jump for you? And as an educator, do you find there's similarities between teaching and podcasting, or are they just two completely different things in your experience?
I don't know if this speaks well of the podcast or poorly of my teaching, but it's kind of the same thing. I was talking to, you know, we just did an interview with my friend Matt Shiflett, who is much more of a full-on academic than I am. And he's a scholar. Let's put it that way. I'm just some punk. But we were talking after the show, and he was saying what a relief it was to talk about Molière. And I said, why? And he said, because I don't get to talk about this when I'm teaching. We've got our concrete areas that we are experts in. We go in, we know that backwards and forwards. I've been teaching The Wasteland every semester for the past 5 years, 6 years. One of my fields is American modernism. I know it backwards and forwards, and that fact makes me sick sometimes. Matt was saying that this was a chance to have an interesting conversation and to do the same kind of prep work that we kind of sort of do when, you know, we're getting ready to stand up and lecture, but doing it about something we don't get to talk about professionally. And there's a lot of fun in that. You know, Daniel and I spent about a year reading Dante. I didn't really realize that until we got to Paradiso. Yeah. It was sort of like, my God, 2016 or 2017 was pretty much just Dante 24/7.
Yeah.
And the prep work that I think we did for that was like getting a lecture together.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it was that way for you, Daniel, but for me, it was. I have a feeling it was, because you kept the conversation going.
Let me tell you something, Claude. I have taken preparing for having a conversation with you more seriously than I ever took any English class in college. I'm 100% serious. But I think what you're getting at, though, in the way that the way it feels to me a lot of the time is that the doing the show is a chance to talk about this kind of stuff as a fan. And so what you get to do, like what you're getting to do, is talk about, like, this is something, of course, that you're interested in. You've devoted your professional life to sort of diving into it. There has to be a kind of, you know, no matter how sick of it you get, there has to be a real abiding love for the kind of material. And it's a real, you know, it can be a real gift to be able to kick back and talk about it in a manner that's more about being enthusiastic and picking your own brain and someone else's about it, rather than presenting some kind of systematized analysis of anything. Although, you know, we analyze, it's just not very systematic.
Well, I was gonna say, like, from our conversation last time on the Paradiso, which gives you an idea that we haven't prepared for Molière yet, but for our conversation on the Paradiso, it was through that conversation that I really became convinced that Hollander's thesis is right. I mean, he was positing this idea that the Paradiso is a kind of epic of crusading. And once we got into that and sort of started testing it and, you know, working with your conversation and your knowledge, I'm really convinced that he's right. So it's sort of like we get to test a couple of things. And the other thing is we get to come at it in ways that I think are a little bit different than the professionalized way. You know, we used to always joke that you've got the four horsemen of approaches to a literary text, sexuality, gender, race, and class. And, okay, it's not that my own reading isn't inflected by that, and it's not that I don't see those as important topics to discuss when doing these things. It's not that I don't see those as important and interesting lenses. It's just not the only one, but it is sometimes the only professional one. Mm-hmm. So there's this, like I said, this affective thing that I think we can get at with the podcast, which allows us to be, you know, to do our legwork, to do our background work, to do the studying, and to get at it and think about what moves us. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, if I could, I wanted to swing to Daniel for a second.
Yeah.
Specifically in this next question, or as I like to refer to him, the Michael Jordan of podcasting.
That's apt.
Damn it, I don't know enough about Michael Jordan to make any good jokes. Sorry, continue.
Let me put this. So you won three finals MVP awards in a row and seven straight scoring titles in a row and walked away at the top of your podcasting game.
Right.
And, I gotcha. You know, now you've been out there, you've recharged, you've refocused, you've made Space Jam, you embarrassed yourself playing semi-pro baseball.
And now you're back in my hometown, in fact. For the Birmingham Barons. Town. Yeah.
But now here you are. You're back with the cannonball.
Yeah. Or rather, so I guess I should say. I'm sorry. That's not Michael Jordan's hometown. He played baseball in my hometown. It was so exciting when it happened. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Sorry, but what was the question?
You have so much in common. There's just so much in common with him.
Yeah.
But the question was, so what about this project brought you back?
Yeah.
Don Quixote.
Well, it was Don Quixote, in fact. I sort of stepped away from Lesser Bonapartes, which has been going strong ever since. Glenn mm-hmm. is absolutely a machine, and everybody else who's come on the show, with Christophs and David and all the other and most recently Bry. What they're doing is, you know, it's amazing content that they keep going, and which I'm really happy for, because I could not keep up. was really kind of what it was all about. But kind of what brought me back into the game, I guess, was in a sort of an earlier iteration of the Cannonball project, Claude had me tapped to read Don Quixote. So I was going to be the person to come on and talk with him about Don Quixote. And it was a pretty wonderful experience, because I had never read Don Quixote. I only knew the barest of outlines, what you might be able to pick up from, you know, glancing at a Playbill cover for, you know, The Man from La Mancha. And but I was really just blown away with not only how much sort of grist there was for conversations I could be having in reading the text, but also just how much. I guess just how much my own sort of peripatetic sponge absorption of a lot of, you know, my broad and shallow knowledge of a lot of stuff would kind of help with, like, when you're looking at, say, like, you know, world literature or something. Like, I dabbled in learning a little bit about the society this came out of. And so that was like, oh, you know, I might actually have something to contribute talking about this. So it was a really cool experience. We ended up recording a couple hours worth of material on just the first half of Don Quixote. And we realized sort of in the middle of recording it, that, like, hey, wait a minute, we can't get to the second half. But like I said, that was kind of an earlier iteration of the project. We've sort of restarted it since then. I guess part of what sort of brought it back in for me is how am I going to put this without sounding all that lazy? Our release schedule is such that I can dedicate a lot more sort of thought to what I can say and what I can contribute, but also knowing that, like, I'm really stepping all over myself trying to explain what's going on here. It's also helping me cover a real blind spot, I guess I could say, that I. Mm-hmm. really have not engaged with very many of the kinds of texts that end up in these lists of the great works of the Western tradition, etc., or the canon, or, you know, what have you, especially not beyond, say, assigned reading. And I very much believe that there is a deeply ingrained part of me that really bucks against being assigned to read anything, because I have all this other reading I want to be doing, you know. So the idea that I would be able to Well, I mean, kind of like Claude said, like, I, you know, we do the reading and we do this prep in much the same way as I would for, you know, doing some kind of like serious classwork or something about it. But the payoff is I get to have this really fun, cool conversation with a pal of mine about, you know, and we get to not only talk about like the sort of the headier stuff about it, we also get to find new and interesting ways to say this was cool and I liked it. So, yeah.
Awesome, guys. So for many people, I think we need to explain who is Harold Bloom and what is the Western canon?
Okay, so this is Harold Bloom is sort of persona non grata within academia. He burned all his bridges around 94, 96, whenever the Western canon came out. Bloom is kind of this weirdo scholar. He's a scholar of no school, though he's associated with deconstruction. He was sort of around at the same time. In fact, Paul de Man was one of his sort of early mentors, or mentors once he got to Yale. He draws heavily from Freud, and his major book back in the 70s was The Anxiety of Influence. It's a bizarre book in many ways. It tries to map a kind of intertextuality. How do you move from one text to another text? How do you define influence between texts? And it's an interesting kind of idea, but it draws very heavily from Freud and Kabbalah in a lot of ways. Just let that sink in for
sounds like the 70s to me.
Yeah, but I think he was sincere about it, and it has the same kind of problem that I think Freudian psychoanalysis does. It's a great mythology.
Yeah.
But when you put it to the test, there's a lot that's really sort of lacking. But anyway, that was his sort of main contribution in the 70s. Earlier than that, he was really kind of crucial in bringing the Romantics back into being considered from an academic viewpoint. He wasn't the only one. In fact, I think his mentor, I believe at Cornell, M.H. Abrams, was really, you know, the guy pushing it, and Bloom sort of got caught up in that. But he was kind of a weirdo because when theory was sort of rising, he sort of, I guess, took himself out of it a little bit. When the English department sort of started bleeding into the sociology department, or the sociology department sort of started bleeding into the English department, that's when he got off the boat. And the Western canon is this book he wrote in the 90s where he basically says, screw all the isms. You know, there are this selection of books that have influenced each other, that have been this set of major influencers. They're unavoidable in a certain kind of sense. And to try to avoid them is to miss the richness of literature. Now, okay, part of what he was doing was burning his bridges. He pissed off a lot of people. And the book is not, like, we were talking about this in the first episode that we did. I can't recommend that book. It's an angry and very ugly book.
It's really, you can almost hear the axe being ground as you read it.
Yeah. And it's the most generous way I can think about it is that it's a cry of pain. Bloom's, he reads aesthetically as an existential thing, and he's very upfront about that. He sort of follows Walter Pater in that his aestheticism is innately tied to a kind of existential despair, and seeing as mortality is a thing, we are reading against time in Bloom's way of thinking about it. So if we only have so much time to get so much in, then why waste your time on things that don't hold up? That's sort of what his idea is. That, I think, is the part of his project that is overlooked. I think that a lot of people mistake him for Alan Bloom, you know, who wrote the Closing of the American Mind. Mm-hmm. And he's not Bloom is not an arch conservative. In fact, his politics swing much the other way. But he is antagonistic towards any critical lens that will use literature for anything, whatever literature is. I'm sorry, it's my own tick. I have to get that in. But would use it for anything other than aesthetic enjoyment, which bleeds away from the existential dread, right? On the one hand, I kind of admire that. I against mortality, he's putting art. On the other hand, I think there's also much to be gained by viewing the political ideologies that inform a work, by thinking about a work in terms of what it says about conceptions of being that we have now that were not maybe privileged or honored in the past, so on and so forth. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think another, I guess, aspect to think of, and sort of where we're coming from in the project of examining, you know, Bloom is of course just like a jumping off point, and we're using his compiled list and whatnot. But I think what both Claude and I would get at is that it's not an either or proposition. You can still enjoy these works as an aesthetic experience, while also, to me, it's very fascinating to examine the, you know, to use these works of literature to examine, well, what were the cultural assumptions that went into them? You know, what were the the sort of baked in viewpoints that we would refer to, you know, that you can refer to a little inflammatorily as ideology. But I mean, you just think of it as, what are the baked in viewpoints in these various works, and how does that inflect our enjoyment of them? But also, you know, there's real beauty to be had in them. But yeah, we're fighting against the either or that Bloom and his detractors have set up. We are the Hegelian synthesis.
There you go.
Yeah,
and you got a new tagline for your show.
Let's put that on a T-shirt. We are the Hegelian synthesis.
Yeah, that's insufferably dorky, but anyway.
But I think Daniel's right, and that's the other thing that I want to reiterate. The list is kind of our arbitrary construct to give, I guess, structure to a podcast. It's bizarre. He wrote this list. What he did was he's got chapters sort of describing and analyzing, I mean, loosely analyzing several world literary figures, starting from Chaucer, going all the way to Beckett. And then at the end, he's got this gigantic list of, I think it's like 15,000 works, that he says, well, these are the canonical ones. Knock yourself out. No. He said his editor told him to put the list together, and he thought it up in an afternoon. He didn't want to put it there, and he's sort of been chagrined by it ever since. He has added, every once in a while he'll come out with a pronouncement with a novelist or poet or playwright who he thinks is canonical or something like that. But the list is kind of arbitrary, and I think that's the point, is that we're arbitrarily using it to, you know, structure this two-man book club we've got going.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you're saying that the list itself almost doesn't matter to Bloom. Am I hearing that right? It's more about the reading?
Well, kind of. I mean, he does have this way of thinking about... Okay, if you look at the list, you can see Bloom's concerns. If that makes any sense at all. There are things on there that you question. You're like, why the hell is he spending so much time with this? And then once you take in certain theoretical ideas he has, or certain biographical things he's talked about in some settings, you're like, oh, well, this makes total sense. Does that make sense? So it's a list that, on the one hand, I find that it's kind of boring because it's got everyone you would think would be there. On the other hand, it's idiosyncratic in that it's also got these things that speak really only to his obsessions. Yeah. So it's, you know, that's sort of how it goes. And one of his obsessions is this idea of influence, or at least it has been for a while. But this idea that certain writers are unconsciously revising certain other writers. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes there are things on there that I think he just put on there because, well, okay, this is some minor point in how Shelley rethought the idea of language. And so, of course, this obscure writer from the 17th century that no one has read or translated in 200 years is going to be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And Daniel, feel free to jump in as well. Mm-hmm. Is the qualifier of Western important for Bloom? Is there a reason that that's his focus?
Yes and no. I'm sorry. I know you asked, Daniel, but I can jump in here.
No. It's fine.
I think Thomas was inviting me if I feel like I have anything to add. Which, hey, I might. Okay. You never know.
He said that that he's delineated it not necessarily because Western culture is the end-all be-all of culture, but because it's what he knows.
Yeah.
And
well, that's easy enough.
At a certain point in one of his later books from like 2002, I think it was, he has a whole chapter on the Tale of Genji. So it's not necessarily strictly, oh, Western culture is the end-all be-all culture, it's the only culture that matters. He's been up front and saying, I arbitrarily picked this because it's what I understand the best, and I've tried to understand other works, maybe I just don't get it, but this is what I know, this is what I can grasp.
Yeah, and I would, please. Oh, yeah, and I would think it's, you know, Part of his project was, or I guess part of his impetus was to, you know, look, we need, you know, to say, we need to recognize that these are the works that the society that you and I live in, myself and this audience I'm writing to, these are the works that our culture has been steeping in for centuries. These are the works that are the background radiation behind the cultural and, you know, literary universe that you and I swim in. And, you know, and I think about that because I think, you know, I'm someone who I am very interested in the vast literary corpus that's out there in these other traditions and traditions and societies. And I also think to myself, well, there's no possible way I can even begin to appreciate it. Like I've become rather interested lately in the, when I realized just what an enormous literary output the Buddhist religious tradition has. This is one of the most literary cultural phenomena that has ever existed. It's truly astonishing to me, like the sheer volume of material that has been produced from within this particular, you know, religio-cultural sort of complex of ideas and conceptions. And I thought to myself, wow, I should really read up, you know, on some of the classics of Buddhist literature. And then again, I thought to myself, there's no possible way I'll ever gain an inkling of an understanding of what this actually means. Because it's not anything that I'm looking back into from the standpoint of someone who grew up in, you know, reading Thai literature or reading, you know, Zen Buddhist literature or, you know, Tibetan Buddhist literature. I didn't come up in the culture that had been steeped in those works the way that the culture I did come up in was steeped in works of, you know, William Shakespeare or Geoffrey Chaucer or various of the other sort of heavy hitters present in the Western canon. So, yeah, I think it's more, I would say it's more a matter of Bloom recognizing his limitations and honestly respecting the existence of these other just incredibly sophisticated bodies of literature that are out there. It's the kind of thing that I take a look at. And I despair of ever understanding American culture fully. And much less the entirety of Western civilization. And I definitely despair of ever understanding Indian literary culture.
Yeah. I think despairing about understanding American culture is part of American culture. So.
Oh, cool. Then I'm on track. All right. Good to know.
Yeah. You're a typical American looking for the American real.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Well, I just don't understand. If Bloom thought he knew so much about, you know, Western literature, how come Tolkien's not on the list? But I guess that's a digression.
I think that's
another one of those axes to grind.
He likes
yes. My big complaint.
You want
where's
the answer?
J.R.R. Tolkien? Here's an answer.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I was just bullshitting, but fine,
no. He's okay. He's this is fascinating. All right. So he kind of burned his bridges, and he's not taken seriously in academia. But he's got this. I think for like the past 30 or 40 years, he's had this thing going with some academic publishing house that puts out these Bloom's guides. So what he does is writes a preface to an author and then collects what he thinks are the most insightful critical essays about him. And they're okay. They're kind of like, if you're an undergrad and a smart undergrad and want to get your feet wet with the criticism, they're not the worst place to start.
As a public librarian who has helped many high school kids with their literature papers, I am deeply familiar with this series of works.
Okay,
and they are extremely
yeah.
helpful. Yeah.
Really, yeah. Really. From the start, they're kind of like a good, smart, early student starter guide, but they don't. Here's my caveat about them. They don't necessarily give the most useful insights from the field. Let's put it that way. They don't necessarily represent the field, and they don't always give the most useful insights from the field. So if you're an upper-level undergrad and you're thinking, aha, maybe this will be my way in, buddy, look somewhere else. but to get back to it, yeah, so a lot of them, he just gets paid to write them, and he just pushes them out. I mean, well, all of them he gets paid to write them, but he just kind of like pushes them out. They're kind of an industry unto themselves, and he does a lot of stuff for the money because I think in the 80s and 90s he sort of, you know, that's just personal shit that I've heard. I don't know if it's true, but anyway, he just pushes them out, and he's done some on writers that he doesn't necessarily admire all that much. Like he did one on Tom Wolfe, and he said, look, I don't think Wolfe is the best one out there, but it's interesting to have a satirist like this to think about what he says about American culture. He's done them on Toni Morrison, and he really dislikes Toni Morrison. But he did one on Tolkien, and I saw it in the library once, and I was like, all right, I got to see what he has to say. And I was just flipping through it, and apparently, if I remember correctly, he liked The Hobbit. Like, he really liked The Hobbit and thought of it as this isn't damning it with faint praise, but really thought of it as fantastic children's literature, like great books for kids. And he said in his estimation, The Lord of the Rings gets bogged down in the World War allegory. And for him, it got too dark in certain ways, like the whole descent to hell, the whole, you know, descent into the mountain and everything. And he said, the older he gets, the more he just sides with Bilbo. Why are you dragging me out of here? I could be at home having lunch or breakfast. And he seems to admire Bilbo's why did you take me from my creature comforts? This is the best that I can, you know, come on. Like, when you're young, you think a grand adventure is what's going to make your life meaningful. And, you know, by the time you're in your mid-30s, man, a really good plate of bacon and eggs and corned beef hash would just be on a nice sort of drizzly Sunday morning where you sleep in a little bit and, you know, the coffee is just perfect. You know, that's life. That's just, you know.
That brings to mind that I back in my swinging bachelor days, my close friend and roommate at the time, we were in fast, you know, in hard agreement that we would sit through a feature length like Lord of the Rings movie that was just Hobbiton stuff. Like, it's just, you just hang out in Hobbiton for a feature length thing. We, you know, just chill. Like, you know, hang out with them the pub, and, you know, it would be great.
Yeah, that was one of Peter Jackson's excised 7-hour parts. Was
extra pub singing in the Shire.
That's right.
Well, thank you for filling me in on that, Claude. It really is closed as a hole in my heart. I don't wonder about anymore.
I believe he hates Stephen King, but I think he's even done one of these on Stephen King. So if that gives you any idea, he just pumps these things out. But every once in a while, if you look around, you can get his thoughts, if you're so inclined, on all kinds of things that aren't necessarily, you know, part of his list or part of what he values. So, you know.
Well, that's good. I hope to know what he doesn't value.
Nah, it's okay.
But listen, I want to know what you guys value. So what work on the list that you guys have lined up were you most excited to take on, do you think?
Oh. Ooh, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be fun to take another swing at Don Quixote.
That's what I was thinking too. I want to really get into that one.
And just because, like, it was, I mean, our earlier conversation was so it just opened a lot of doors, and I'm interested to see, like, coming back, like, you know, over a year later, like, how I'm gonna what it's gonna mean to me.
I personally want to see what happens to Daniel when I pull Faust Part 2 on him.
Well, that was gonna be the other thing I was gonna say is one thing I'm really, really looking forward to is the poetry that we're going to tackle, because great literature is a pretty big blind spot for me. Poetry especially is a giant blind spot for me. And it's really, which is a real shame, because when I do read it and I engage in it, I really enjoy a lot of poetical work more than I ever thought I would. So I think honestly, and Faust, of course, you know, given the, all the hermeticism and Renaissance magic afoot in that particular work. That'll be a good one to chew on. Yeah,
it's all hermeticism and fart jokes in Faust and
like all good literature.
Yeah, and bizarre metaphorical, orgasmic, what have you. I'm going to have to, I got to see if she'll do it, but I have a friend who's a German professor in Colorado, and I feel like we're going to have to stagger episodes on Faust Part 2, that Daniel and I are going to talk about one act, and then I'm going to have to talk to her about the act just to ask what the hell just happened. Faust is one of those works that I own like 3 or 4 translations of, and I always go back to it because I'm so damn confused by it. It's one of those things where I feel like I keep reading it and reading it, and I cannot get to the bottom of it. It's like, what exactly are you doing? What does this mean? I feel like it needs an annotation as in-depth as Dante.
Yeah.
Like, but it's never going to get that because it doesn't have that kind of reputation. It's taken as this other thing.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so bizarre. It's so bizarre. But I want to see what happens when Daniel reads the end of it, because the finale is just, wait, what? Okay, the finale, I don't want to ruin it, but the finale of...
Yeah, no spoilers on this 300-year-old.
the finale of Faust Part 2 could only happen in an episode of True Blood. Like, that's the only...
All right.
Tonal wet, like, it's so tonally bizarre that I can only think of it as an episode of True Blood.
All right, and it's one, like,
it's just
to find out what happens. You'll have to listen to the comic.
That's right. That's right.
Or just read this 500-year-old.
Well, what else besides the great works, guys? Do you read if you have time to do that? What are your guilty pleasures? What would populate your nightstand?
It's funny you mentioned guilty pleasures. There was a time when I would be guilty about my pleasures, Tom, but that time is over. To my mind, pleasures are just pleasures. One of the things looking over the Bloom's list that made me think, you know what, I'll give this guy a shot. Like, this is going to be like kind of a deep project. He's got my girl Ursula K. Le Guin on there with The Left Hand of Darkness, which is one of my absolute favorite books of all time. I really, most of my reading is genre reading in science fiction and fantasy. And I'm really snobby about it, which is probably the most embarrassing part of it all. I would be less embarrassed if I read trash genre fiction, but what I'm most embarrassed about is that I'm very snobby about my genre fiction. So really, anymore, actually I just got, I can't remember the title now, but I found us, I saw an article on a blog about, some kind of notably bizarre 1970s black urban fantasy voodoo noir detective novel that has this kind of outlandish reputation that I'd never heard of. So I was able to get it from my library. I got it in today, so I'm very excited to read that. but that's generally the kind of what I'm working at. I really enjoy if I'm reading fiction, I really really enjoy the fantastical. I kind of need that almost, but also at the same time, just having a neat spaceship just doesn't cut it for me the way it used to. So I'm trying to thread the needle of the fantastical, science fictional or fantastical in general. That also the writer has really, you can tell that the writer has put a lot of sort of thought and effort into the language itself. So Le Guin, Gene Wolfe, I think is one of my favorite authors who also, if you ever want to sort of examine what happens when an extremely Catholic person becomes very damaged by speculative fiction, read some Gene Wolfe. There's some fascinating stuff going on there. But really more recently, I've discovered an author. Well, she's new to me, who actually passed away fairly recently, a few years ago, Sherry S. Tepper. And she was one I would highly recommend if you're like me and you enjoy the fantastical, but also desire the kind of flowing and lyrical, a very lyrical style. She's absolutely terrific. And Claude, I just really took all that up, didn't I?
and Claude, would you like to add anything?
I'm teaching 5 courses this semester and tutoring 4 hours on Saturday morning and watching my kids. So if it's not a student essay, I'm not reading it.
A time when you had time to read.
mostly this stuff, though, I take diversions into esoteric bullshit, let's call it. And that actually has a lot to do with the literary. I kind of got into it from Elizabethan Jacobean lit, where there are all these references to bizarre, esoteric rituals and ways of thinking. Part of the historical stuff led me back to, oh, hey, here's some weird bizarre idea about the constellations that really makes no sense considering what we think of in terms of modern physics, but whoa, what a bizarre metaphor. So strange esoteric weirdness or any kind of esoteric bullshit is always kind of fascinating to me. Not necessarily because I believe in it, because mm-hmm. it's, I guess, access to the mystical, or the claims of the access to the mystical, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do drugs these days, so whatever can can suffice literarily.
Yeah.
But yeah, if that gives you any inkling.
I'll take from that what I can. So it's just in a way of wrapping up here, guys. You know, do you think you'll be diverging from Bloom's List at any point, or covering some people who are not on Bloom's List? Even if you get through it one day,
we're not even through Bloom's List. I don't know if we're gonna get through the main list itself. I mean, who knows? We might be dead by the time.
Well, but see, that's the thing. You know, we could always do. Yeah. We could take. Well, you know, you've played video games, Claude. We could do side quests.
Side quests?
Yeah.
This is all dependent on what won't give Josh, our editor, a heart attack. I think
if we do, it's going to have to be into some, like, classic esoteric bullshit from the Renaissance.
Yeah. No, because the third member that you're not really talking to is our editor, Josh.
Oh, yeah.
Our producer. Sorry, he's a producer, not an editor. Well, I guess he does both. But, yeah, he is just a saint, because he just out of the blue. He was visiting New York, and we were hanging out, and he said, hey, that podcast thing you were thinking about doing, if you ever need somebody to put it together, hey, I'm your guy. And I said, sure, why not? And then we talked it over, and I got back in touch with him and said, so were you serious about that? He's like, yeah, once a month, I think I can swing it. So he's got his own stable of podcasts that he records and produces himself, and then just does ours on the fly for nothing. And that's the other thing. If we could, I think side quests and things like that would be a whole lot of fun. I just don't know what stress that would add to the system. But I do think that's a good idea. Like, there are some things that are sort of off the beaten path that I want to take on from time to time, to sort of poke through and see, okay, what makes a work canonical, what makes a work non-canonical, what do you think makes a work worth reading, and what is not. I'd really like to pick your brain sometime, Daniel, about sci-fi and fantasy, because I know that's something you're really invested in, and that seems another gateway drug. A very smart friend of mine, who's not Daniel, has been trying to get me to read Gene Wolfe for a while now, and it's one that I want to. It's actually one that I do want to pick up, because it seems right up my alley. But
yeah. I'll have some, I got a hit list for you. We'll work it out.
If you can grade some of my papers,
right, we'll do an exchange. Yeah, I hope those kids love a slapdash job on grading, because I go by impression mostly.
Oh dear.
Well, guys, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me tonight. It was great having you guys on the exchange. And any final thoughts, any plugs or promotions you guys want to share before we say goodbye?
Oh, gosh. Well, thanks for having me on again, Tom. It's my second time here on the exchange. It really is always a pleasure talking with you, man. It is. It's a lot of fun doing the show. Well, I don't know. We should probably, you know what? We should do Josh a solid and plug some of his, you know, our producer Josh. He has a regular project, Predictocast, which is a lot of fun.
He and a friend of his watched the first couple minutes of a movie, and make predictions about what's going to happen in it. And then they watch the rest of it and gauge how their predictions worked out. And so they're always finding just weird stuff from the stretches of the internet. Josh knows obscure bad movies like you wouldn't believe. I mean, he's amazing. And then he did this thing, and this was like, if Monty Python had a podcast, it was sort of like what Jonathan Swift did for books and what Monty Python did for all media. Josh did it with this thing called Butterfly Kisses, where it starts out that he and this friend of his, I believe it's part improv and part loosely sketched together, but their plan is, you know, they set out, they're kind of goofballs who are trying to listen to and analyze songs with butterfly in the title. And every episode is, no episode is longer than, I believe, 7 minutes. And so they're just breaking down Butterfly by Crazy Town.
Noted new metal rap hit Butterfly by Crazy Town.
And it just, like, you have to listen to it from the very beginning. There's one episode that they do that they restart 5 times in the episode and just play it off like they never edited it. It's like this weird thing. Like, okay, I messed up. I'm just going to start again. Okay, 3, 2, 1, and then they go off again. But yeah, and that's... reintroduce it like 3 to 5. It was either 3 or 5 times. It's a work of art unto itself. I mean, it's sort of an anti-podcast. But if anybody, if that sounds like it's up anybody's, it was up my alley. Like there was a moment in it where I just completely lost it. I was listening to it on headphones and I just rolled over on the floor. They do things like have a Slurpee drinking contest, so 30 seconds is just the sound of Slurpees. I mean, I'm not doing it justice, but please listen to that thing. It's called Butterfly Kisses, and it's just, I don't know, it blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind.
So it's the kind of thing where, you know, no matter how stupid I sound doing the cannonball, I'm okay with Josh editing it because of, you know, knowing what he does on his projects.
Yeah, but he's a genius and a gentleman, and that guy, yeah. Well, so any goodness that can come his way is well deserved.
And do you guys have a website?
Yeah. Vamp for a second while I try to remember what it is.
All right, I can cover for you here. I can cover for you. Yeah.
Okay. No, but it's thecannonballpodcast.wordpress.com. I just set up a WordPress blog. And it's just where I sort of post the episodes. And there are a couple blog entries here and there. Just one or two things have come up during the, during the recording. I'm like, oh, we could go back and revisit that. And so I'm working on something now because when I was talking to my friend Matt, I messed up a point that I was trying to make with Beckett. And couldn't really go back and re-edit that out. So I'm like, aha, vindication. I'll just write about it on the blog. So, we've got postings there. There's a contact there if you really want to get in touch with it. I don't know why you would. But,
please do.
You know,
we're very friendly. We have had friendly emails. It's been pretty fun.
Well, again, guys, thanks so much for stopping by, and have a great day.
All right. Oh, sounds no great. Problem. Thank you. You too, man. Thanks.
All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that. I had a lot of fun with Daniel and Claude, and I hope you did too. Make sure you check out their website and give them a listen. If you missed the link that they gave in the interview, you can go to agorapodcastnetwork.com and find a link there. Okay, everybody, that is all I have. So until next time, cheers, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you. Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out for a chance to win the French Open title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV, live in HD. Don't miss a moment with daily live coverage and match replays on demand, beginning Monday, May 20th. Be there for all the unforgettable moments. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.